Hey, and welcome back to the A24 podcast. We've been trying to get First Cow director Kelly Reichardt on the podcast for the better part of a year, and we finally found her perfect match in brilliant writer, director, and playwright Kenneth Lonergan. Kelly and Kenny have notably both directed Michelle Williams in some of her greatest performances, so we were surprised to hear that this was their first time meeting. Speaking of which, we're thrilled to announce we're getting ready to make Kelly's next film, Showing Up, which will also star Michelle and shoots this summer. We hope you enjoy this conversation between Kelly and Kenny, featuring special guest, Brownie the dog.
All right. Let's talk about our taxes.
I'm going to get another extension. That's the entire... Yeah. I don't think I've ever skipped one.
Yeah.
Should we just dive in? Or?
Sure.
Should we just start? Okay. Well, hi, I'm Kenneth Lonergan, talking to...
Kelly Reichardt on the A24 podcast.
For the A24 podcast. Hi, Kelly.
How are you?
I'm okay. Long Island. Where are you at?
Portland, Oregon.
Oh, nice. So you actually live in Portland. You don't
recently, moved. I mean, I was in New York for 30 years and ending up spending more and more time out here, and then kind of made the shift from Queens to Portland.
But you've made so many films, and how many of your films take place in Oregon?
Quite a few. Five, I think, yeah.
How did you happen to end up there, or start out there, if you don't mind, if you haven't answered that question too many times?
I followed Todd Haynes out here. He was I worked on Poison back in 89 and became pals with Todd. And, he moved out here, and I thought, really, it was very crushing that he was leaving New York. But I started coming out to visit him, and I, in one of those visits, met Jonathan Raymond and forging a relationship with John. And so we started, we made out Old Joy out here first, and then where I met Neil Kopp, the producer of that short, and the sort of Portland family kind of built out from that. And John just kept, he's born in California, but grew up in Oregon. And so the work out here has really stemmed from working on his writing. And then, I made one film in Florida and one out in Montana that was based on some Miley Malloy stories. But all the John Raymond stories have been various corners of Oregon, a very diverse state.
Did you know anything about Oregon before you moved there, or before you followed Todd out there?
No. The first time I was ever here, I had visited Seattle for the first time, and Todd was out there with Safe at the film festival. And a mutual friend of ours, we drove Todd from Seattle down to Portland, and I remember it was pouring rain. And my first impression of Portland is so much that day, but just a rainy day near Powell's having lunch. And I was just here for a day. That was the first I had ever visited it. And then I just started coming out. So it was, to me, it was so exotic looking compared to, I'm used to it now, but at the time, coming from sunny days of Florida to the rainy days of Portland.
How old were you when you emigrated from Dade County?
Dade County?
Isn't that where you grew up?
Yeah, it is.
I looked that up.
Wow, very good.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, I guess I must have been around 18. I went to Boston very randomly first on my way to New York. I know, it doesn't sound like on my way to New York, but anyway.
I know what you mean.
But yeah, and I ended up going to art school there, the museum school, and just being there for 4 years, and then I finally got to New York.
You know, there's something about the West that is just, I don't know what it's like to grow up there, but for an Easterner, when you get there and the scale of everything is so different, and it's, you seem to breathe differently, and I don't know what, the sky, that big sky they always talk about, and everything's just so outsized, it seems at first. I've never lived out there, but I've been. But Oregon's got kind of an interesting history. I was reading about it a little bit, and it's such an interesting combination because it's so considered so progressive and liberal now, but it has this terrible, particularly interesting history of racial laws and it's established as a free white state or an attempt to make one. And it's just interesting. It's an unusual, I don't know if it's a blend because I don't live there, but it's just an unusual.
It's not much of a blend. Portland's a lefty place, but Oregon's not.
Yeah. And but most of it has a lot that sort of, it's sort of west, east, west, isn't it? Isn't it somewhat politically, with the coast being more liberal, if you want to use those words, to, and the eastern half being a bit more, much more conservative? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. You get out like to the high desert, and also a lot of the conservatism is about logging.
And, oh, yeah.
And that's a big political thing here, the, you know, save the tree people versus the loggers.
You know,
but the fires settled a lot of that argument, I guess.
I'm sure. Well, I know in Massachusetts, a lot of the local people who had used to make their living fishing were not complaining about conservationism, but they were complaining about, in great detail, about government regulation being so haphazard and random, and not having anyone in the Fish and Wildlife Department who knew anything about fish or wildlife, and not that they were limiting fishing on certain species, but that they would come in, there just was no scientific analysis of how to keep the fish populations going. And then, of course, and I don't know if that's the same with the logging companies out there, because it's not that they don't want the fish to be wiped out either, but they do need to make a living, and there is a way to do it without you know, using up all the fish. They're supposed to switch fish populations, and the licenses change, and they,
right,
you know, you would buy a license to fish a certain kind of fish, spend a lot of money on the license, and then that December the regulations would change and your license would become worthless. And but the perception was that they were simply didn't care and wanted to use up all the fish in a very short-sighted way. But I don't know if there's anything analogous like that to the logging industry.
I'm not really sure. I know when we were first scouting for Old Joy, and Neil Kopp would drive around, and there was the explanation that you weren't allowed to clear cut near the, like you had to go deep in so you wouldn't visually see the clear cuts. I
right.
mean, places we shot in Old Joy, you could go back to, and they're clear cut right up to the road. That doesn't seem to exist anymore. And I think the argument has something to do with the, you know, there's not biodiversity in a new forest that you're constantly replanting.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly not an expert on it. When we shot out in Eastern Oregon, which is a super conservative, out near in Burns, where the I'm spacing on the name of the guys who took over the Bundys. They held up an area right where we stayed in Burns, Oregon, because they were want all the land to be ranch, free range ranching. But they weren't even from Oregon. But when we were there, everyone's politics were based around cattle and where their cattle could go and where they couldn't go. Like, I had the impression as an East Coaster that, you know, the conservative ideas were all, you know, moral or abortion based or whatever it was. But when we were working out there, my impression was that everything just had to do with so much closer to, had to do with ranching. And in fact, when those guys, I guess, came to this, there's a beautiful bird sanctuary out there, which is right where they hunkered down, the Bundys. But talking to people who still live there, they said, you know, people have lived there for generations, going back to, you know, the wagon train story that we were telling out there, and they had never known their neighbor's politics until that episode took place out there. And sort of felt that the place would never be the same again after having that, which it's interesting to think about, because on the coast, everyone wears their politics so on their sleeve all the time.
Yeah, it's an area that people feel so passionately about, but the combination of where their strongest feelings go is always seems to me it's like there's a wide dispersal between things they really know a lot about and are very close to home, and then there are these ideas that we all have about subjects that we don't actually come into close contact with in our daily
right.
you know, in normal life, but we feel just seem to feel just as strongly about them, and even more outraged and frustrated when other people don't agree with us, even though we've never, some of the strongest opinions about issues that I didn't agree with I've ever encountered were people who had never met anyone who was not like themselves. But on the other hand, they knew a lot about their own area, whether I agreed with them about that or not. It seems like such a
true,
such but an yeah, odd,
but it's also true
dynamic.
That, you know, like New Yorkers or city people can have almost what seems more of a diehard environmental kind of, you know, appreciation or guardedness for areas, natural areas that you might never get to, you might never see.
I guess it's because they tend, and they're accused of, and not entirely wrongly, I think, of it's where you vacation, but it's where we have to make a living. But I'm curious, like, did you, now that you've done all this stuff about the 19th century West, I'm just curious, were you drawn back into the past by accident, by interest, a lot of your work's about what was happening, not now, but then, and obviously very much connected to what's happening now, but what do you think, I don't know, it's a sort of a vague question, but I'm really interested in that period myself, and I'm curious what you found out about it that you didn't know, or what
Every time every time
you find,
dive in, I am aware of how much I don't know. You know, I would have thought that some of the things from 1845 when we did Meeks would have easily transferred over to 1820, which was First Cow, but it was actually really a different scene in that the 20 years made a big difference. The migration hadn't really started yet. People were coming by boat and more from Europe and not trekking across country yet. I guess I always have this naive feeling of the sense of corporate corruption, as in something pure existed in America, not just like in a First People kind of way, but as if there was, as opposed to that it was from the very, very beginning, it was, you know, it was a power structure set up to not work for the environment or for the people that were already present, and that I guess I am constantly interested, and I think John Raymond also, in the first seeds of capitalism and how, just by its nature, it's not something that like turns, you know, that it's problematic from the very beginning.
It's interesting too, that period, because it's the pioneers are very much breaking out on their own away from all the restrictions. You know, I often think, like, how desperate must you have been to make that journey, whether by land or by sea? I mean, you had to be really in need of something above subsistence in order to go through all those hardships.
Do you see yourself as a person that would have made the trek or not made the trek? I always ask myself that.
The way I turned out, no.
There was a lot of fake news about what the trek would be like.
I'm sure. Many of these people had already come over the ocean, and they had come from abject poverty themselves, so they were very tough. But they were also, I don't know. I mean, while they're taking everything away from the people who are already there, who had been taking it away from each other for centuries, they're also escaping the terrible bottom rung or second to bottom rung of the European and other societies they're coming from. So it's, I guess in a way they're starting a new kind of capitalism or a new kind of business political structure, but it's one thing about the old pioneer days that I think is certainly true is they really were out on their own without much law for quite a while. And yet I'm always struck by the image of people recreating the structures they're getting away from, even when they're out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because there's, you know, seems to be constantly in the American, never more today as much as any time, this idea of wanting to, of absolute freedom and absolute rights and anything your heart desires is yours because you're American. But at the same time, wanting things from a government and presuming things from a government and also still wanting some kind of class system, I think, seems built in to it all.
But do you think that's a particularly American thing, the wanting a thing, that things falling out or being pushed into a hierarchy of some kind? Because that's something that seems common to all.
Yeah. I guess I think what's American
structures.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, but what strikes me as American, the idea of the sort of don't tread on me, it's my right, I have maybe it's naive, an idea that in the beginning of the American, you know, experiment, that there was maybe more of a, maybe not though, because the films sort of defy this all the time, but you know, it's more research we do. But this idea of a joint adventure, that it wasn't, that the, I don't know, it's a complicated thing, like where did the individualism come in? And I guess in a way that was part of the beginning of the experiment, but.
It's odd because they're, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's okay. I don't really have a conclusive
thought. It's half my personality and half the microphone. Well, there's the dog barking. Let me just see if this is our big arrival. Hold on.
Okay. Bring the dog.
I hope this is adding color to the podcast and not not wrecking it, but they'll tell us. There's something about the idea of striking out on your own, perfect individuality, completely self-sufficient and wanting to be left alone completely, right alongside with the really rock bottom feeling that you're spreading civilization as you go.
Right.
Cuz so they're both starting new and bringing with them, well, all the way through the 19th century, the idea that they're the greatest humanitarians of those period, the people who really really respected and thought the Native Americans were being mistreated and had much more we would call liberal ideas. There wasn't a single one of them who didn't, the most, what we would, progressive solution was to get them out of their life and into farms and clothes and Christianity and what was thought of as civilization, you know, white civilization. And that was as enlightened as they got. And we like to think we'd be much more enlightened, and I'm 100% we would not. But there's something about that being the foundation. Meanwhile, they're completely out on a limb themselves. And again, I guess you can't go out. I guess it's more unusual to just, you can't leave everything behind, no matter what you do.
I mean, even physically, the stuff that's being taken with them and being thrown out of the wagons along the way.
Yeah.
But
and in Meek's Cutoff, they're bringing everything with them, but they can't use it.
Yeah, you can't use it. Yeah, what you need is water.
Yeah, and you need someone who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
In order to survive, it's a very terrible and interesting problem, and I do think. But the other thing I think I see in your films too is and what you're talking about is the idea that you're claiming perfect freedom and individuality while you're supported by this immense system behind you when you need it. It seems invisible just to, again, back to the Indian Wars, their settlers would break the contracts that the government had made, then some of them would be murdered, and then they would be in an absolute rage if they weren't given military support to avenge the murders that had been committed while they were broaching the treaties that had been made. So they're completely on their own, expecting full support while not actually abiding by the rules laid down by the government they're calling in to help them when they're broken against them. Terrible English and syntax, but you get what I'm saying, I think.
Yeah, I think it's complicated, and everything's regional, even then, how different tribes operated and different laws amongst each other, and who would was willing to partake in trade early on and who was resistant to it. Yeah, I mean, every time we wade into one of these period pieces, and you know, it's sort of like the thing, the more you know, the less you know kind of thing.
Yeah.
I do, yeah, it is interesting. It also, like, you know, it's easier once you just start focusing on the characters you're trying to fit into this world, so you can focus on the smaller task that they have to get to, as opposed to the larger political landscape, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's something that your work is really interested in, is this really immediate challenges that they're that your characters are facing and how they're facing them.
Yeah, when we were, it's interesting, when we were shooting Meeks, because we were really out where the part of the wagon train exists, you know, got lost. And there's just nothing has happened out there since. We could still find pieces of wagon wheels and stuff or an old grave. But we would always, you know, we moved from this point of what do you think they did, to starting to just think like, well, here we are, a group of people, and we have we're in this situation. We have to get this wagon down this hill, and these are the tools that we have with us. Like, what would we do? Would the thinking really be that different? Like, here are the tools. What do we do? Instead of constantly trying to think of like, what would, you know, just logic, I guess, of what you have at your disposal. But yeah,
that
yeah.
seems to be there's an and to ex, by extension, I guess, with First Cow, here we are. We're getting subsistence, and how can we make more of it? Like the First Cow Corporation, so to speak, is a first natural extension. Once you've got enough to eat and drink, how do you lift yourself up a little higher
a
than
little
that?
Further. And make yeah.
That's such an interesting idea.
Do you ever think of venturing into out of contemporary?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, as it happens, I've always been interested in the period pieces, and I love period films, and I love history, and I almost only read history. I don't read. I have a lot of trouble with novels, and I tend to read history, American history, and I like the Middle Ages, and I'm reading a lot of Roman history at the moment, mostly for fun. I've always wanted. I have a couple of things that I'm working on that are not contemporary, and I hope they fall into place, because I'm really interested in the past.
Where's
and
your
how
family
people,
from?
My family's Ooh. From my mother's family's from are Czech and Russian Jews, respectively. Her father and mother's parents, and then my father, it was French. His parents were French Irish, so it's a, I guess, French Irish, Czech, Russian Jewish, yeah. Like a big blend. Very New York City. I don't know. I'm actually not that conversant with the first half of the 19th century, where you've been spending so much time, and not so much out west. But I've been reading a lot about the Indian Wars recently, which are terrible and fascinating on so many levels.
Yeah.
But I'd love to. There's so many challenges to it, and I think one thing, the way you put everything right on the ground, I think is such a great way to deal with it, because I feel like a lot of period. So many period films and TV shows you see are just the challenge of actually getting into the mindset of the past is just either not something they're focused on, which is fine, or something that's just too difficult. So you get this either very sort of stiff formal approach mixed with this complete abandonment of any attempt at verisimilitude. And it's also, I always think it's fun to watch different films from different times in the 21st century and how they interpret or look at the past, because, and of course, you know, the old saw is that you're telling much more about the time in which you're making the film or writing the book than you are about the content, but the relationship between the two is always so interesting.
Yeah, I always feel out of my depth talking about the content, I try to I'm very nuts and bolts person, but I feel out of my depth quickly. I was up at Bard showing First Cow, and I was starting to talk about it, and I realized, you know, the room was filled with some historians that put me, yeah. So I just was like, I have to quit talking right now. And just, but it is, it's nice to get into things deeply, though, into, you know, when you get to the point where you're just focused on, like, what a day would be and how much work there was to do in a day. And, you know, and once you're, have everything around you that's just from the period, and those are the tools you have in your hands, those are nice. But then there are some scenes, you know, with the Toby Jones scenes that were taking more into account the where everybody, you know, sort of is in the pecking order and trying to make that happen in some kind of, you know, just sort of dealing with that within a room, which is challenging. Yeah. But
it's so challenging. I mean, I think I always feel like whenever I'm in a situation in real life that I've, that's an environment I've only read about or seen on TV, I'm always, there's always this shock of the difference and what the, you're like, oh, this is what it's like to be in this room. And this is what they, this is what they're focused on, or this is what the, this is what it feels. It's so different. Have you, I don't know if you know the Lyndon Johnson books by Robert Caro.
Yeah, so
he has that amazing chapter where he talks about the Lyndon Johnson bringing electricity to the remote areas in Texas, which had never, and the lengthy, detailed description of what life is like for the farmers and the farmers' wives just getting water into the house, and what it meant to have the electrification for the, if that's the right word, for that whole area. And you can't get a sense of what that meant without all that detail, which is, but I think that's why your approach to history I like so much, because you're just down there with them in the, at the well, and with the, getting the wood from them. There's that one shot in First Cow through the doorway where he goes all the way to get the firewood and then he comes all the way back in. And I don't remember at what point in the movie it is.
Yeah, it's funny too sometimes when actors have a task, how they can't leave it incomplete, you know, when they're really into it. And so you're just like, wow, he's really going to chop up that whole tree before he comes back in. Okay.
I saw an interview with Orson Welles once, an old interview with Orson Welles, where he's talking about American movies and foreign movies. And he says, I was watching a German movie, and on the character, there's this, the camera was placed on the corner of this building, and the looking very down the long wall of this building that went all the way down into the distance. And the character came around the corner. I thought, my God, is he going to show her walking all the way down the side of that wall? And by God, that's exactly what he did. And but speaking about actors, you reminded Mark, in my movie, You Can Count on Me, Mark Ruffalo had a, this is the first, I'd never directed a movie before, and Mark had to, there was a scene where he was fixing a broken pipe and a hole in the floor. And so the plumbing wasn't in the shot. You could just see him working on something, and there was, he had tools and greasy pipes and parts around him. But there was nothing for him to actually do in the hole, and I thought it'd be fine because he wasn't on camera. I thought he'd just pretend and do something. He got really mad at me. Well, he didn't get really mad at me, but he got quite annoyed because he didn't have any, it was just fake right below the, the level of the frame. And he said, this is not, I have nothing to do here. There's no, So next time we had him work on something, we made sure it was all screwed in and he had actually something he could do with his hands.
Yeah, that, I think You Could Count on Me could be a good double feature with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, just as far as sibling movies go. Favorite sibling films. Not that they're very really, different, but nevertheless, is that Ruffalo? I think that's where I was introduced to Mark Ruffalo, was in that film.
Probably, yeah. He had done, that was his, I think that was the biggest part he'd done since he'd been doing theater in L.A. for previous 12 years. That was his first big part, so quite likely that's where you saw him first.
Here's a casting question I wrote down, because this is constantly on my mind. Casting's always so hard to talk about for so many reasons, but when you love an actor and you think they're incredibly talented, do you still feel you need to, do you cast for the essence of what that person is? Do you feel the most kind-hearted person you know could play a dangerous, really dark heart?
It totally depends. I think it depends on the actor, because there's some people who just aren't going to serve the role. There's things about each role that I think can be dispensed with, and things that really you need to have in the part to make the movie make sense. And there are some actors, every actor has a range, and I think some people can go very far away from, some people I know people who are bitter and sarcastic and snarky in real life, but only play kind of more cuddly parts, and it's just a part of themselves they don't bring to their work. and vice versa.
That direction seems easier to me for some reason.
Which one? To go from mean to nice or nice to mean?
To me it seems harder for the good. Good, I'm using like good, not that anybody's an angel, but just to go to dark and menacing seems a harder direction.
Yeah, but I think it just depends. I mean, some people just have a natural menace that they can call up, and other people don't seem as formidable or frightening in that way. I don't know. Yeah. I've seen it. There's so many varieties to it. I mean, Henry Fonda, for instance, but he always has a slight edge to him, even when he's playing a nice person. But then, of course, in Once Upon a Time in the West, he's a hideously cruel villain, and he's just great. But I think it just depends, really.
Yeah, but when you read his kids' biographies, you think he might have had some of that in him.
Yeah, I think so, too. Having seen him, you get that. You don't get the feeling he was the warmest, fuzziest person.
No, not at all.
So that doesn't really... Yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel like it's a...
Could Mark Ruffalo play an evil person?
Yes, I think he could, because he's... First of all, I think he does have great range, but I think a lot of actors don't like to play evil parts. It's a more old-fashioned problem. There were certain... There are actors in old Hollywood who just had a certain persona they didn't want to go against. But nowadays, when things are supposed to be more flexible and you're supposed to be more of an actor and less of a movie star, but I still think some...
You think today that's true? You're supposed to be more of an actor than a movie star? God.
I don't think it is true, but I think that's the I think that's the popular feeling, or that's the fashion.
Really?
I don't think it's necessarily the case. It depends completely on which actors you're talking about and what genre they work in. But yes, I would say there's less conscious. I think there's supposed to be less conscious awareness of what the role is going to make you look like. I think you're supposed to be an actor who can do all sorts of different things. And you know, like people like Clark Gable and stars like that would not play certain kinds of parts because they thought it just made them look weak, or they thought it made them look, or that some people were afraid. Not as simple as being afraid to do comedy if that's not your thing, but not wanting to be perceived in a certain way. And I think that still is true, but it's not what you're supposed to be like.
Yeah.
Do you have a different feeling about it? I'm sorry, A24. Hold on.
Bring him to the table.
Okay, the barking's not totally over, but it's going to go down now. All right, sorry about that.
I don't mind.
So where were we? Do you feel that there's more of a movie star mentality now than there used to be?
I feel... Well, there's just so many outlets and magazines and judgment and of actors and just constant analyzing of people's looks. I do sometimes feel, you know, if you're watching like some British films, you know, Mike Lee or even watching, you know, The Crown or whatever, and you say, wow, that 50-year-old woman looks like a 50-year-old woman, or that guy looks like he's never been in a gym. That's good. Where it just feels more like a job and less like without all the added stuff of what American actors sort of have to jump through. Like not being a 50-year-old in a character way, but just being 50.
I know what you mean.
I think it's difficult here, but I do kind of always, you know, Todd Haynes and I often have the question of just the idea of, I think I tend to cast close to, you know, what I can see in someone, and there's sometimes like a idea in our he I think does too, but you know, Scott Rudin will get into a thing with you about actors that don't seem like you see it, and then you know, but can you pull someone to be something that's completely different than who they are, I guess.
Yeah. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Let's just let this go so we don't drive them crazy.
See, if you showed the dog, it would all work out. Oh no, because it's not a... for your still photo.
Yeah, we'll put the dog... Yeah. I'll get her in the photograph.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
You make the dog work in the...
yeah.
It always makes things better if there's a dog.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. I think that there are parts that there are certain kinds of casting that seem completely crazy because the person doesn't seem like they're anything like the part. And then there are other time there are other instances where it happens that although it's not the type of role you've seen the person play and it's not necessarily close to who they are naturally, it's something that they can do and that there's a part of them that can move over to where that character is. I would to take Mark as an example, just because we know him so well, I think he has great range, but outside that, there, you know, I think his capacity to be, for instance, malevolent is—he's one of the nicest people I've ever met.
Right.
But we all have our selfish, we all have our side, which when it comes up, mm-hmm. it's not so pretty to look at. And I think some actors are very good at bringing that out when it's appropriate. Mm-hmm. And if they're not afraid to show that side of themselves, they can be quite effective, even though in real life they may be a pussycat. And there are some people, I feel, some actors who have a kind of an innate, my wife would call crunchiness, not in a granola way, but in a, just sort of a, there's something about them that seems a little bit aggressive or angry, or and that's part of who they are. And there's some roles that you might not want them in because that's always simmering underneath, and you don't, that's something that wouldn't be in the character.
But yeah, that would be the trick, to make it simmering underneath with someone that just doesn't have it simmering underneath, you know? Yeah. Like, you have to bring it out a little bit more.
I've been watching this footage. I've been listening to an audiobook about the Ronald Reagan years, and I remember, this is a bizarre association, but I'll go with it.
Yeah.
His performative self was so genial and so... joke telling and so wise and so whimsical and tough, but he wasn't a particularly good actor when he was an actor, and I didn't think he was a particularly good performer when he was the president, but a lot of people liked him. But you can see in certain press conferences when he loses his temper or someone makes him angry, his mm-hmm. whole face changes, and Christopher Hitchens once described it as he becomes like an angry lizard.
Yeah.
And he's very frightening and formidable, and really, like, you take a step mm-hmm. back and you wouldn't want anyone looking at you like that. But I will bet you anything that's not something he would ever have been willing to or even able to bring to an acting role.
To an acting role, yeah. That's interesting.
Because as a more shallow actor, I think, he would, that's not something that would, wouldn't even necessarily want to acknowledge he had in him.
Mm-hmm. But that's because he was doing the bigger performance of being a politician someday.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Or a bigger performance of a nice guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they're all different, which is part of what's so much fun about them. I mean, do you feel like, I heard an interview with Truffaut once, or I read it, when he said he always, once he's shooting a movie, he always tries to bring the characters closer to the actor because the actor is what he's got in front of him.
Exactly. I think so. Yeah. I think that happens no matter what. You start out thinking it's going to work in the opposite direction, and then you realize, when a character's in your head, you can change it every day. And the thing of casting someone is you've now... something's more concrete. That person has a voice and a body and a physicality, and some things are going to surprise you that are going to be wonderful. But there's always the limitlessness of being able to change your mind every minute of what you're doing.
Yeah.
Is that has passed. It's funny with Michelle Williams, you know, it's always seems like we're about halfway through the movie where she's sort of says, I really getting a handle on this character, and I'm always thinking that the character has come to meet, you know, that there's a melding.
A
yeah, there's a meeting.
Yeah, but I always find that's what I unless the actor is exactly what you imagine, which is never.
Yeah, that's never.
I always feel it's always a flux where how much the part is moving towards them and how much you want to get them to move towards the part.
Yeah.
And that's always fun to play around with and always interesting because there's certain things, I mean, I always feel like there's certain dynamics in a situation and in a scene that are just the template has more or less got to be that. When you undo them, the whole thing falls apart. And then there are other things that really have to be enlivened and refreshed and beefed up and taken over by the actor completely. And you're always wrong about which ones are which.
Yeah, it's... if I could picture something completely before I started easily with an actor, I think I would just not have the energy to make the film. I want there to be a surprise element. I mean, it's like everything. I think I've been doing, I was shooting some just some 16 millimeter of some different artists in their studios, just wanting to watch people make things and that are tactile and happen before your eyes. And there's, you know, there's a randomness in, I think, all all art, and, you know, thank goodness, that where, you know, you have the, you can see people are working towards something, but there's also constant surprises that you need to turn into something that's in your working in your favor.
Yeah.
And I think that's
where it always gets the most, you know, the feels the freshest when something comes up spontaneously, yeah. But it's always such an odd balance because you don't, a long time ago, they used to say actors are not spontaneous. They plan everything, every right. gesture, every word. Now we're going back a couple right. of centuries, but the illusion of spontaneity is something they rehearsed rigorously. And I always just think that those performances, if that's what they were actually doing, must have been just crashingly boring. But I also don't quite believe it. I believe they probably worked very much like best actors do now. They really thought about what they're doing, or they had an innate sense of what was happening pretty, you know, moment to moment before they got started, and then they, some kind of life is breathed into it, or they really worked through it and figured out what they were doing, and when they're performing, something else happens that is a surprise and is an accident. And I find that's what happens in all art, like when you're writing and when you're directing. And as much as directing is unspontaneous, a film anyway, because it's so mechanical, even when you're doing it on a small scale, it's a little, but even so, you're like, oh my God, the wind is blowing, that tree looks really, is bending over in that certain way, and we can just turn the camera around. That's a sort of spontaneity.
Yeah, if you're on a location shoot. I mean, I would think in theater that there'd be less, in a way, I guess maybe performance-wise there's more spontaneity, but there's less in the physical space that's gonna surprise you.
Yeah, that's true, and all you have to, I would characterize it as different, not so much more or less. There, you're doing the same performance every night, and there are certain things the actors, it changes every night, and you don't lock it down, finalize it, and walk away from it ever, which is what makes it fun for people who like to do it. But you can't, there's certain things, you can't change the blocking really any more than you can wander away from the camera and mm-hmm. still, there's artificialities are different, I guess is how I'd put it. Mm-hmm. Like you have to speak louder so the audience can hear you, you're facing out more, your body language is restricted, and film actors who do theater are often really surprised on their first few encounters because they feel very strange talking as loud as they are, and it just feels so phony to them that they can't. But somehow it becomes no less, it becomes possible to be natural at double your natural volume, the same way it becomes natural to speak to someone with a microphone hanging over your face, 6 inches over your head, on a film set. And right. experienced film actors simply don't notice them anymore, or with a whole crew watching you when you're supposed to be alone in a room with someone. So I think it's a question of what the artificialities that you have to get used to are and being spontaneous within that. And I would say that most theater actors would say there's much, yes, like you say, there's much more opportunity for spontaneity inside of a play, in a way, but you can't change the performance completely, take after take, the way you can if you feel like it in a film.
Right. I mean, plays seem, I don't have any kind of natural affinity for the theater. I find it curious to watch, but and maybe I'm not watching the right stuff or haven't seen enough stuff, but I always feel like I'm watching people doing things. I've never really been, it's always been sort of so outside my expense level to go see, you know, a lot of theater in New York. Though I saw some Shakespeare and that sucked me in more than I thought it would, because it was just sort of the whole thing felt of a whole. I mean, you have to give it more. You have to, like, buy the scenarios more. You have to, like, as an audience member, you kind of have to meet it more fully than it doesn't all just get handed to you on a...
Yeah, I think that's true. You have to... the suspension of disbelief is required is probably greater. But I also suspect you haven't seen
enough really great plays
because it's like anything else. Most movies are bad. Most books are bad. Most paintings are bad. Most music is bad. Most plays are bad. The thing about the plays, though,
is because
you're trapped there with a live performance, and there's just essentially, no matter what's happening, it's people walking around talking. I've always thought it was much more excruciating to be bored in the theater than to be bored in a movie. Movies have flashy lights, and they have music, and they have the scene changes every couple of seconds, and there's indoors and outdoors. There's a lot more going on in a bad movie than in a bad play. In a bad play, it's like you're socially trapped talking to a bored person, and you can't get out. Right. But a good play is as good as anything. They're just harder to come by.
I think it's that you've made a fair assumption there.
I don't like to presume.
No, but that is. I would say that I haven't seen exactly what you said. If I, you know, it's like I sent someone to sit in front of Netflix and Amazon, whatever, with a clicker and said, "Here, watch the first five films and make your judgment on cinema."
Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah, it is a bit. I think so. I think there's hope for the. Yeah. For you in the theater.
Yeah, I know. I need to, you'd have to just go more, and I think.
Yeah, I think so. You just need to get the breaks. You know, you just, like some, I try to steer people towards certain movies that I like and that they haven't seen, and if I get the wrong one right off, then they're much less likely to give me a chance for the second recommendation. I much prefer a bad old movie because I enjoy the patter and the cadence and the I like black and white and I like the way they talk. So when it's a lousy movie and they're saying say I guess I love you, like that sounds good to me, whereas I have many friends who when they see that color they're just turned off or shut out, they feel it's artificial. And I try to, I like to point out that whatever we're doing is going to look just as artificial in 70 years, no matter how natural we think it is.
Yeah, and I'm not against the artificialness of a world at all, but yeah, I'm much more forgiving for a different generation of film than I am for the one I work in.
Yeah, it has some anthropological value to it. It's got a fun of a cultural difference embedded in it in a way that a contemporary film doesn't necessarily have. What I think is really great and makes me feel happy is how a very good movie from a completely different country, like where the language doesn't even sound similar enough for you to be able to follow. Like if I watch a South Korean film and I'm just listening to the dialogue, I don't know when the characters are angry, making a joke. Like there's no. Yeah. The musicality of the language is so completely different that from English that I couldn't, only by reading the subtitles, unless they're really yelling or laughing, those two things are easy to recognize. But the general cadences of speech are impossible to follow. But the fact that if it's good, whatever good means, you're really suddenly in that room with those people following that story. And I just think that's just magical, even if you're missing a lot of associations that a South Korean audience would be picking up on following and being involved by. But I think that's a real encouragement for the human race, not to be too grandiose about it.
Wow,
but I do love that about.
That's a good note to end on.
Okay.
You were ending on the human race.
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
Well, we need the help.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's lovely to meet you virtually.
Yes, you too.
Well, I hope you have a safe, good holiday there in Long Island.
You too.
And
you too. And
thanks for talking.
Yeah, it's great talking to you too.
Yeah.
All righty.
I'll see you in the flesh at some point.
Yes, I sure hope so.
Okay.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening. The A24 podcast is produced by us, A24. Special thanks to our editor Tom Wyatt and Robot Repair, who composed our theme.